Good morning. It's Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. It's November 2nd, 2020, and we'll begin on the front page with the article headlined, Flying Clear, East End Grill at Decatur Airport Can Continue Indoor Dining. Tony Reed writes, Everyone's East End Grill restaurant, parked within the confines of Decatur Airport, is now taxiing to an enviable position. It can cheerfully ignore Governor J.B. Pritzker's orders to shut down indoor dining service starting Monday. That's because the new, stricter shutdown rules for this region, aimed at limiting the spread of COVID-19, don't apply to eateries that are deemed part of essential businesses, like airports. It just so happens the airport restaurant won't be open Monday anyway, but only because that is its regular day off. Normal service from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. will be up and running Wednesday through Saturday, with Sundays 6 a.m. until 2 p.m. Tuesday they normally close at 2 p.m. as well, but will stay open this Tuesday, voting day, until 8 p.m. as the airport is a polling spot. And we're going to run a little special, said Nick Morgenthaler, who owns the East End Grill with his wife, Stephanie. If a diner has got their I voted sticker on, they might get a free piece of pie or a cinnamon roll. Should the governor stop by, however, all he is likely to get served is the cold shoulder. Morgenthaler said he'd be tempted to stay open in any case, even without the air cover of the airport as an essential business, because he said the virus shutdown targeting indoor dining is just unfair. If you can go to Walmart and you can go to Menards, you should be able to come to a restaurant, he added. I think restaurants are a target of convenience. And I don't believe anything the governor says. I think his virus data is skewed and not accurate. The state health department on Friday said Region 6, which includes the Decatur area, would be under new restrictions to contain COVID. On Sunday, the region north of Decatur, which covers Bloomington Normal, was added to the list. Among the restrictions are a ban on indoor dining and bar service. Morgenthaler, who spoke while taking a quick break from serving all-American breakfasts with all the trimmings Sunday, also wondered how the state can effectively cripple a whole business segment and offer it no means of support. A lot of these restaurants and other businesses are not going to survive, he warned. Outdoor dining is not going to work in a Midwest winter. The restaurateur said he acknowledges COVID is real and it poses real risks for some people. But statistically, he said, most Americans stand more chance of being badly injured or killed every time they climb into their car or truck. He said we are willing to accept that risk as the price for living our modern lives the way we want to live them. And he said eating out in a restaurant in the time of COVID was far less risky than the car journey to get there. It's like President Trump said, Morgenthaler added, you can't let it run your life. You can't be scared of it. If keeping this restaurant open sets an example and shows people that, we're happy to do it. He got no arguments from his Sunday morning post-church dining crowd. Cindy Haynes and her husband, Butch, were both enjoying fried breakfasts they said tasted as good as the food's looks and aroma suggested, and were also deeply satisfied with the attitude of their host. Yes, said Cindy Haynes, 56, pumping her fist in the air when told the East End Grill is exempt from the governor's virus rules. Their food is amazing, their staff is always happy and friendly, and we want to support them any way we can, she said. And I think the governor is overreaching. He's closing down our state, and we're closing down America. And if we don't instead start putting America back together again, we and our economy is going to go so far down the rabbit hole, we may not be able to crawl ourselves back out. And next, COVID, the numbers. Illinois reports 6,890 new cases. New COVID restrictions start Monday in the Illinois Public Health District region that includes Macon County, which on Sunday also reported 73 new infections. Region 6, which includes Champaign-Urbana, joined the list after its 7-day rolling positivity rate on coronavirus tests hit 8.6% on Tuesday, exceeding the state-established threshold of 8% for the third straight day. Restrictions include bans on indoor dining and bar service, and limit gathers to 25 people. On Sunday, it was announced Region 2, which includes the Bloomington Normal region, will have the same restrictions applied on Wednesday. That will mean all 11 Illinois regions will be operating under tighter restrictions under Governor J.B. Pritzker's reopening plan as the coronavirus continues its statewide resurgence. The State Health Department on Sunday reported 6,890 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, with 35 additional deaths. The recovery rate as of Sunday was 97%. State data shows. The death total in Illinois since the start of the pandemic reached 9,792 with the latest numbers. There are 417,280 confirmed cases of the coronavirus in the state. Sunday's confirmed cases were the result of 78,458 tests conducted Saturday, placing the latest 7-day positivity rate for COVID-19 at 8%. As of late Saturday, 3,294 people in Illinois were reported to be in the hospital with COVID-19. Of those, 692 patients were in the ICU, and 284 patients with the coronavirus were on ventilators. Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike urged people to make pandemic-guided decisions and to avoid in-person gatherings on Halloween weekend. The return of restrictions has proven controversial, with some restaurants vowing to continue indoor dining. The state has reported 410,300 confirmed infections since the pandemic began. The 7-day statewide positivity rate, covering October 24th to the 30th, is 7.5%. Region 6 stretches from Decatur to the Indiana border and includes Mattoon-Charleston, DeWitt County, and Effingham. In Macon County, COVID cases total 3,728 since the pandemic started, county officials said. And continuing on the front page, 2020 election. Biden, Trump in final stretch. Joe Biden was spending the final days of the presidential campaign appealing to black supporters to vote in person during a pandemic that has disproportionately affected their communities, betting that a strong turnout will boost his chances in states that could decide the election. Biden was in Philadelphia on Sunday, the largest city in what is emerging as the most hotly contested battleground in the closing 48 hours of the campaign. He participated in a Souls to the Polls event that is part of a nationwide effort to organize black churchgoers to vote. Every single day we're seeing race-based disparities in every aspect of this virus, Biden said at the drive-in event, shouting to be heard over the blaring car horns. He declared that Trump's handling of COVID-19 was almost criminal and that the pandemic was a mass casualty event in the black community. His running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, was in Georgia, a longtime Republican stronghold that Democrats believe could flip if black voters show up in force. The first black woman on a major party's presidential ticket, she encouraged a racially diverse crowd in a rapidly growing Atlanta suburb to honor the ancestors by voting, invoking the memory of the late civil rights legend, longtime Representative John Lewis. President Donald Trump aimed to blunt the effort by arguing that Biden and other Democrats have taken the support of black voters for granted. Show Joe Biden and the Democrat Party what you think of their decades of betrayal and abuse, Trump told supporters on Sunday at a rally north of Detroit. With more than 91 million votes already cast, Trump and Biden are out of time to reshape the race. Instead, they're focusing on their base and making sure that any potential supporters have either already voted or plan to do so in person on Tuesday. For Biden, that means paying close attention to black voters who are a critical part of the coalition he needs to build to win. His campaign's final burst of travel was tailored to boost that support. After Philadelphia, he was to be in Cleveland and Pittsburgh on Monday. And after that, and after stops with Biden in Detroit and Flint, Michigan on Saturday, former President Barack Obama heads to Georgia on Monday. 4 years ago, Trump made his pitch to voters of color by asking, "What have you got to lose?" in supporting the Republican candidate, and aides have pointed out that pre-pandemic economic gains by people of color. He won only 8% of the black vote, but in a development that has haunted Democrats for 4 years, Hillary Clinton's margin fell 7 percentage points from Obama's in 2012, according to Pew Research Center. There's little chance that Trump will win all that many more black voters this year, though his campaign believes it has made inroads with young black men. The president's primary strategy has been to erode Biden's support with a barrage of negative advertisements. When the pandemic reached America, Democrats spent months pushing their supporters to vote by mail. But their energy has shifted to urge black supporters who have long preferred to vote in person or distrust voting by mail to get out on Tuesday. Biden's campaign has tried to reverse the drop in black turnout from 2012 to 2016, with decreases in cities such as Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Philadelphia that contributed to Trump's upset against Clinton. A Biden path toward victory must include black majority cities, including Philadelphia and Detroit, which will be crucial in determining the outcome in Pennsylvania and Michigan. Those are states where both candidates have spent a significant amount of time in the final days of the 2020 election. The historical, but also cultural, reality for our community is that Election Day represents a collective political act, and it's a continuation of our struggle for full citizenship in this country, said Adrienne Shropshire, the executive director of Black PAC. Black voters are showing up in ways that they did not in 2016, and we can take heart in that. In Detroit, officials are projecting a 50% voter turnout, which would be higher than 2016, yet lower than 2008 and 2016, when Obama's candidacy drew record voter participation. Grassroots organizers in the Philadelphia area have spent months engaging potential voters, many of whom they expect will be casting ballots for the first time on Election Day. "Most black voters in Philly have been skeptical of mail-in voting," said Joe Hill, a veteran Democratic operative turned lobbyist from the city. "A lot of us have gotten our ballots already," Hill said, but added, "Election day has always been everything in Philadelphia." Healthcare Pennsylvania, a local union chapter of the Service Employees International Union, is working to increase turnout by at least 10,000 in West Philadelphia, and spent the weekend knocking on more than 600 doors. West Philadelphia has a majority black population and has experienced firsthand the convergence of the pandemic's disproportionate impact on black Americans and protests in recent days against police brutality, mirroring what's occurred nationwide. In Philadelphia, Biden played up his local connections. He lives less than an hour away in Delaware, and his wife Jill is from the region, and urged supporters to deliver a victory in a battleground state that Trump may not be able to win without. Trump, in a tweet Sunday, claimed that Biden called young black men super predators, which he did not do, though he used the term predators in a 1993 floor speech to describe criminals. And moving to the local and state page, military collection up in flames, to be rebuilt. From Hannah City, "This all started, this passion for collecting U.S. military-related memorabilia, when Jerry Lance was six. That was 53 years ago. I got my dad's Navy uniform, and I was hooked on the military after that," Lance said. "Him and all my uncles were in the Navy. Every time somebody got out of the Navy, they went home and left their uniforms with my grandmother. I was sitting in the front room one day, and for some reason she got up and said, 'I bet you'd want this.' That was the beginning." From that humble start, Lance built a collection of thousands of artifacts from both world wars, the Vietnam War, and other American military conflicts. "Everything I saw, I had to have it," Lance said. "The older I got, the more I realized all this stuff is history, and people are throwing it away." Now, because of a fire last month at his Hannah City residence, it appears Lance will have to throw away most of his collection. About 7:30 p.m. on October 13th, a few hours after Lance had perused some of the items stored in his garage, he heard a popping sound. Then he looked out one of his house's windows and saw a big red glow. The Logan Trivoli Fire Department, Fire Protection District, among three other departments, was able to bring the blaze under control within about 25 minutes. It wasn't clear what caused the fire, although Lance said he used halogen workshop lights when he visited the garage earlier. Damage to the building wasn't extensive, Logan Trivoli Chief Dave Tuttle said. Damage to the contents was irreparable. The Peoria County Sheriff's Office reported Lance's military collection was worth about $100,000. It was the product of years of visits to garage sales and auctions, among other sources. Lance accumulated uniforms, boots, helmets, Bibles, photographs, even portable toilets and operating tables. "I just started collecting it and it got out of hand, as my wife was telling me," Lance said with a chuckle about spouse Rochelle. "Some of it's salvageable, but most of it is gone for good. Honestly, it's just stuff. It's nobody's life." Lance's life long has been connected to the Navy, and not only through his ancestors. He was a sailor, too, from 1979 until 1987. "All Lances go in the Navy," he said. The Navy took Lance to Lebanon, among other places. He said he helped rescue from the water Cuban refugees during the 1980 Mariel boatlift. Once Lance returned home to the Peoria area, he went to work for Caterpillar Inc., from where he retired. But he never quit collecting material. Lance wasn't sure if insurance will cover his losses. When the fire struck, he was just starting to catalog his collection. But replenishing began almost immediately. About 12 hours after the blaze, Lance visited an auction house in Farmington, where he acquired an Army ammunition belt. On Thursday, a Vietnam veteran who had heard about the fire drove 75 miles to give Lance a hat from the war. "I collect a lot of local people's stuff because I want to preserve it," Lance said. "That's what it's evolved into, preserving the history. I'm a history nut. It sounds kind of corny, but all those guys in the military were heroes, and I just want to preserve their stuff." And another article on COVID-19. COVID-19 swamps rural hospitals. The nation's pandemic hotspots have shifted to rural communities, overwhelming small hospitals that are running out of beds or lack the intensive care units for more than one or two seriously ill patients. And in much of the Midwest and Great Plains, hospital workers are catching the virus at home and in their communities, seriously reducing already slim benches of doctors, nurses, and other professionals needed to keep rural hospitals running. Nationwide, positive coronavirus cases started rising in mid-September as children and college students returned to school, more businesses reopened, and more people started resuming daily activities outside of their homes. Wisconsin and other less populous states became the new hotspots. This week, per capita rates of COVID-19 were highest in North Dakota, followed by South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, Nebraska, Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, Iowa, Arkansas, and Illinois. Hospitalization rates also were rising in those states and others. Healthcare experts expect a seasonal spike in flu and pneumonia, combined with a steady rise in COVID-19 cases, which will swamp many healthcare systems, particularly in rural areas. Wisconsin recently opened a 530-bed field hospital on state fairgrounds in Milwaukee that was set up in the early days of the pandemic, but sat unused until now. Last week, 50 beds were readied for patients, and the staff was working on transfers with hospitals that were hitting their capacity limits. The number of hospitalized COVID-19 patients in the state tripled in the last 30 days. In Oklahoma City and the surrounding area, no ICU beds were available last week, according to the University of Oklahoma. The lack of beds required medical professionals in those already understaffed hospitals to spend hours on the phone arranging patient transfers to other Oklahoma hospitals. Fewer than 20 ICU beds were available in the entire state of North Dakota, according to state data. That meant patients had to be transferred hundreds of miles in some cases to South Dakota and Montana. Wisconsin averaged more than 3,000 new COVID-19 cases every day last week, and nearly 1,000 COVID-19 patients were in the state's hospitals every day. That's compared with a daily average of fewer than 300 COVID-19 hospitalizations in the state in early September. Hospital workers there are feeling the emotional distress. "They're angry," said Tim Size, executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. "We keep asking people to wear masks and social distance, and they don't change. Healthcare workers don't understand why so many people are acting as if the virus doesn't exist. They just don't understand them," Size said. They're acting like we're not all in the same community, he said. But the virus thinks we are. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Wisconsin's deeply divided government has been unable to work together to promote evidence-based public health measures. And even now, as Wisconsin leads the nation in new cases and hospitalizations, the Republican-led legislature is refusing to work with Democratic Governor Tony Evers on a statewide plan, Sy said. About half the population wears masks and the rest don't. They say in Wisconsin you can guess how a person is going to vote by whether he's wearing a mask, Sy said. The current COVID-19 wave in Wisconsin was predictable, given the lack of mask wearing and social distancing, he said. But it's really sad because we're going to have a rough fall and winter, and it was preventable. Nationwide, healthcare experts expect the current nationwide COVID-19 wave to last until at least January, surpassing the two previous waves in case counts, hospitalizations, and deaths. According to the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, nearly 129,000 U.S. hospital beds will be needed to care for COVID-19 patients by January 2021, when the Institute expects the current wave to peak. That compares with an estimated 69,000 beds used by COVID-19 patients in April, when outbreaks in New York City, New Orleans, and other cities peaked, and 62,000 hospitalizations in July, when the second virus outbreak peaked. And local government, council to discuss property taxes. The Decatur City Council on Monday is expected to discuss options for handling the property tax rate. In a memo to council members, City Manager Scott Wrighton and Treasurer Greg Ziantera said options are being presented in the interests of holding the line on property tax increases. During the City Council's periodic 2020 study sessions to review the city's financial health, and in light of the economic and community impacts of COVID-19, the City Council expressed a clear desire to avoid tax increases in working its way out of the city's fiscal constraints, the memo said. The draft tax levy ordinance has been prepared in accordance with this instruction. The property tax levy funds police and fire pensions, the public library, debt service payments, and the Decatur Municipal Band. It doesn't pay for day-to-day operational costs of municipal government. The council agenda for Monday also includes approving spending $34,177 to buy additional police body cameras. Also, accepting $29,430 through a Department of Justice program for addressing gun and violent crimes. And authorizing a agreement of $213,200 to Esri Inc., which handles various digital tools for property inspections, neighborhood revitalization, grant fund justification and expenditure tracking, economic development, street conditions tracking, and public transportation route analysis, among other things, that city employees and the public use. The meeting is at 5:30 p.m. in the Decatur Civic Center Theater, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for November 2nd, 2020. We will take a short break now and return with the second half hour, and I look forward to reading with you. Please stay tuned.